Good morning. Hawaii's legislature thinks it's a good idea, and would-be organic farmers certainly do. Today, we'll talk with one who'd like the state to help fund organic certification. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Also, in the scheme of edibles, you already know that bees play a significant part. We'll get an update on the outlook for bees threatened by a predator you may not know.
There's lots of buzz about Kona Coffee, but what about that other world-class island coffee district? Later this hour, we'll get a primer on the brewer from Kau with the Hawaii Coffee Association director. That's Chris Manfredi. I'm Bill Sage. Imagine it's 1986. You're 12. Your mom gives you a 20 at the Comic Con and says, make it less. Jimmy J has done that for 30 years. The amazing Comic Con in Hawaii.
It's Friday, May 13th, and that's the conversation. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and good morning to you for one final morning that you're with us today, Bill Sage.
Without triskaidekaphobia, he said, wondering. You know, it's a weekend, so I'm ready to relax and enjoy the things I dig, like the Beatles. You know, they've been part of pop human culture for over 50 years, but the Beatles in hive culture, that's a different tune.
You bet, and we're going to talk about that today because that's not really something that we hear coming from the songbook about how the bees are faring in Hawaii. Now, for years, you've likely heard that Hawaii's bees are under siege from varroa mites, colony collapse, habitat degradation. Concern over a lack of bees hasn't caught up with reality, according to Dr. Michael Clicks. After his stint as a honey producer, he's now a bee manager and pollination expert, and he says the bees are doing just fine, thank you very much. That doesn't mean that they don't have threats, and these days, that means the small hive beetle and humans. Dr. Michael Clicks joins us this morning with an update on the bees. Good to see you again.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We've talked bees for a long, long time.
We have indeed.
And in looking at what we understand now about the bees, are people still carrying a lot of ideas that we might have talked about 5 or 10 years ago?
A lot of people still believe that there's a severe global threat and or a severe local threat to honeybees, and that might threaten pollination and crops. That's not true, but there's still a lot of press about it, and some people have a vested interest in seeing to it that that gets out to the public, and the public, of course, doesn't have a lot of options about finding out that that's not true.
So who has a vested interest in saying that?
People are selling things that will be more costly if the bees aren't going to be there.
So you're talking about some of the products and things that people might find online and fallacious commentary about what bee products may or may not do. But in terms of the rest of us who—
And their books that they're selling.
That too.
And their products that they're selling, yeah.
But aside from all of that, you know, marketing in a lot of people's mind, you know, Shabai, what about the idea that the bees that we need for pollination, the bees that, you know, depend, so much depends on the bees, that really is a very different situation than we've thought in past. And we haven't really talked about some of the real threats to it. What do you see as being real threats to bees right now?
Well, just speaking about Oahu and the state of Hawaii in general, it may be different among the orchards and almonds in California. But just here, we have plenty of bees. Over the last 3 years, the El Nino weather, we've been having lots of humidity, a lot of plants flowering earlier and often. We have more swarms that are happening than we've ever seen before. And I've been following this for 25 years with data, people who call in who have problems with bees, and it's clear that there are plenty of bees right now, and they're normal, healthy bees. The hive beetles do get some of these colonies, especially the wild ones, but then the wild ones will stay strong enough, they'll keep the beetles down. So it is a problem for beekeepers who don't know what they're doing. And they may have a hive that they're playing with in their backyard. They don't keep it strong enough. And they come back one day and pull a frame out, and they see thousands of beetle larvae swimming like eels inside their frames. And the next day or two, the thing turns to slime and it's all gone. That's management problem.
Which is to say that this is a human problem.
it's a problem about not having enough skills or money to be able to manage the small high beetle threat.
So in looking at that part of how humans may respond to the small hive beetle, you're also talking about how Hawaii, and in particular how Oahu, has been changing in how the land is used and what that means for bees, and also how people are, you know, making reports of bees swarming in places they haven't seen before.
That's correct. And it's interesting. It's not just bees, but it's other creatures that live in what we consider to be wastelands, land that is not usable for anything else. It used to be ranch land at one time. For instance, out in Kunia and other places where these large townhouse structures have gone up, they're getting a lot of problems with wasps, several kinds of wasps, not just the mud dauber wasp, but the paper wasp and Polistes wasp and others, because the wasps now no longer have a place on the ground to keep their nests. So they're going to the people's structures. Bees, to a certain extent, are doing the same thing. Some of the natural habitat of caves and small holes in the ground and trees have all been taken out. So the bees don't have enough places to nest. And, like I said, we don't have enough beekeepers to control all of these swarms. We do our very best. But last year, I estimate that there were more than 1,000 swarms just on this island alone that we know about. And, of course, many swarms happen in remote areas that we don't even see. And it's a normal behavior for bees. They're not swarming because they're sick.
Right, so let's talk about that a little bit, because when people see swarms, there might be an inclination to think that there's something wrong, or why are they coming into this area? Well, you've talked about some of why they might be moving into that area, but as you mentioned earlier, as an El Nino year where you have more flowers that are blooming more frequently, there's more enticement for the bees to move out. You've got queens who are laying and aging faster, that it seems that you have the confluence of all of these things which are causing, you know, the bee population to escalate. That may be a good thing, although there are certain controls there, but also that they're swarming looking for places to be because a lot of those places have gone away.
It's all of those things and perhaps more. It's more complicated than I'm sure we understand. But bees usually swarm, as a natural phenomenon called reproductive swarming, and they prepare for that. It's a process. Before they swarm, they've detected already that the queen's pheromones are dwindling, her perfume is dwindling, and that the colony will not be held together very well for a queen who has no strong pheromones. And it's not the queen that determines this. It's the workers. Actually, the workers control the colony, not the queen. So the workers then will decide they're going to try to make a new queen. So they will take certain one-day-old larvae or two-day-old larvae, and they'll feed them thousands of times a day royal jelly. Not hundreds of times a day, but thousands of times a day. And those two-day-old larvae will become queens. And once there are half a dozen of these queen cells being reared in the colony, then the old queen will be leave voluntarily, or she'll be forced out. And she'll take with her enough of a retinue to take care of her during the period of swarming. So she may take 5,000, 6,000 bees, half the pollen, half the nectar, and swarm out. Generally, she'll go and hang out on a branch or a bush someplace nearby, a site that the scout bees have already predetermined is a good place to make a new colony. So if you see a swarm someplace, that's telling you somewhere nearby there, the scout bees have previously determined that there are good sites. If they're not there by chance, and from that first resting site, they'll probe again. They'll explore that area again. And eventually, within seconds, they'll all disappear to the site that the scout bees have told the queen. The consensus opinion takes about 20 bees. They'll go there, and that's it. It's over. So our role as managers is to get to that swarm before they go into your house, your car, your garage, your attic, and catch those bees and put them into a nice hive box, take them away, and make them into good citizens. Of course, there's a chance that that queen is old and will not last long. But we can give them our new queen. We can get them from Kona Queens on a big island, put a new queen in there, and it's all over again. So it's not a pathological process.
So what should people do, though, if they find that they, you know, have bees taken up close to their house or their car or a boat or someplace where the bees don't really belong according to, you know, human use?
Well, I wouldn't say bees don't belong anywhere. I think they belong everywhere. But I understand what you're saying. They're inconvenient. It's a nuisance.
Or it could be dangerous.
It could be dangerous. Well, if anybody sees a swarm on their property or other property, they should call the honeybee hotline and report it. And we can discuss with them, or we'll locate who the owners are. Many times we have to go to the state library and look up the address and get a tax map and find out who the owners are, call the owners so they can be made aware of it. And the important thing for the owners to consider is that those bees are on their property. They have a liability exposure. It may seem unfair, but if that bees do something on their property, they're responsible for it. So we offer to go out and catch the bees. There's a fee, but there's no profit involved here. It's just cost recovery. And we'll go out and catch those bees as fast as we can.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the update on the bees and a little different story than what we've been hearing of late. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Michael Clicks is the owner of Honeybee Management Services and Island Pollination Services. He's the former owner of Manoa Honey Company and a former president of the Hawaii Beekeepers Association. He holds a doctorate in entomology and parasitology.
You can go there if you please. Why?
I'm Ira Flato. If you're a bird watcher, you might want to try bee tracking. On Science Friday, bee expert Tom Seeley gives a lesson on tracking bees and why it's more than just a hobby. Also, tales of bird watching with a personal point of view, and hunting morels, those edible mushrooms. They were delish. All on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's 8:15. Coming up, something amazing and quite comic. But first, your quiz from the backyard.
Well, hopefully you were paying attention to Dr. Michael Clicks, because today's backyard quiz will test your knowledge of honeybees. A single bee will produce only about a tablespoon of honey over the course of its lifetime. But fortunately for honey lovers, a single hive can contain up to 50,000 bees. It can take over 5 pounds of nectar and more than 500 bees to fill a single 8-ounce jar with honey. To put it in perspective, that translates to almost 1,200,000 flowers. Much like wine and coffee, the taste and character of honey is greatly affected by the region in which it's produced. Here in Hawaii, we actually have a type of honey that's found nowhere else on Earth. And today, we'd like you to name it. I'll give you a hint. We talked about it earlier in the week. If you know, you might be today's winner. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets the HBR t-shirt.
Good morning. I'm George Cleveland from Tamworth, New Hampshire. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Asking anyone with the dominant nerd-geek gene when they first became aware of comic books is a bit like asking when they first became interested in breathing air. Back in 1986, our next guest's mom handed him a 20 at the San Diego Comic-Con and said, "Make it last." Well, he's made it last 30 years so far. Jimmy J is bringing the amazing Comic-Con to the Hawaii Convention Center next weekend, and he joins us by phone. Aloha, Jimmy J.
Aloha. I really appreciate you having us on the air and being able to speak with your audience and you about the amazing Hawaii Comic Con.
I mean, I think about shows on the air. Of course, The Big Bang Theory is a wonderful vehicle for people. Yeah, we're out here. We've always been out here. And Hawaii, too, has a lot of comic artists. When you bring the amazing to a region, you also highlight people that are homegrown.
Absolutely. I think it's important that we don't just bring out the creators of our pop culture, the architects of pop culture, what I like to refer them to. I mean, last year we launched our event with folks like Stan Lee, and this year we are following that up by bringing out the publisher of DC Comics, which is Jim Lee, as well as the biggest television producer, Robert Kirkman, of The Walking Dead. So these are big marquee talents for the world of pop culture. But I think what's just as important is that we promote them alongside the great creators that we have locally here, not just in Honolulu, but throughout the entire state of Hawaii.
Could you give us a rundown on some of the people who are here?
Well, fantastic.
I think we've lost a signal here for a second, but as we're waiting to get reconnected, I would just like to point out that comic books in and of themselves used to be regarded for many parents that don't read those trashy comic books. They're just for kids. And yet, I hearken back to my childhood, and I think about learning the lowdown and really improving the ability to read. You remember Classics Junior Illustrated? I mean, some of the great books that were, they're kind of thick volumes, and yet if you put a picture worth 1,000 words, but you put some of those...
Now we call them graphic novels. We look at them a little bit differently, but they've been able to sort of increase their status by having maybe a different title put to them, but still the idea of getting a child's interest, becoming intriguing, and then keeping that following on. I think Jimmy J's back.
As a matter of fact, yes. Now, we're illustrating what just happened, a little dropout, and in our next comic book, which is called Radio Illustrated, Jimmy J can explain how much more dramatic that dropout would have been if you could have seen the picture.
Oh, absolutely. No, there's crashes and bangs, and we had four-color superheroes coming in to save the day.
Exactly.
But more important than that, what we were talking about before is that we have this great marquee talent, such as the creator of The Walking Dead, the DC co-publisher, the person who created the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and more. But what's just as important is spotlighting folks like Sam Campos of the Hawaiian Comic Alliance, who has spearheaded an independent comic movement here in Hawaii. So he'll be out here, as well as some great creators like Roy Chang, who has an independent book, Stacy Hayashi, who has a historically accurate story that's based in Hawaii with Japanese troops that fought for the U.S. in World War II. So we have these great creators that are local to Hawaii, as well as folks that grew up in Hawaii that are returning, like Matt Nastos, who is a Disney creator and has worked on the Power Rangers comic. He's grew up in Honolulu and is coming back for the amazing Hawaii Comic Con, as well as Mike S. Miller, who, again, grew up in Hawaii and has worked for the DC Injustice video game franchise. He'll be back here as well. It's important not just to bring out these marquee creators from the mainland, but also to promote them alongside creators from Hawaii that are independent, as well as people returning to the island who grew up here.
It's also wonderful to note that no matter where you go, the homegrown people, the interest in comics, because humans are so visual as well as verbal, and the stimulation just last week was the National Read Comic? All of a sudden, I'm losing my reading ability. But free comic books last weekend, which gave the idea that you can learn to read. The literacy is so much improved by comics.
Absolutely. And I think that there's something for absolutely everybody inside of the comics medium. So, you know, we hear this term, you know, comic books or graphic novels, and they can mean a number of different things, just like, you know, a film or a novel would be. So it's like you have material that is great for kids. You have material that is edgy for adults. You have spandex superheroes. You have drama. You have horror. You have slice of life, just like absolutely any other medium. And you'll find all these things at the amazing Hawaii Comic Con this next weekend.
You also have I remember those little stamps in the upper corner when I was buying, approved by the Comics Code Authority. Is this sort of like the MPAA? Does that still exist, or is that a relic
of the
past?
You know what? That has been phased out. That was like a big, you know, having that Comics Code, that was showing that there was approval for parents out there. But it meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and it was definitely a hot button political movement in the 50s and 60s. Only a few years ago, both Marvel and DC Comics and most of the mainstream comics moved away from using that as their grading system.
But
most comic book companies, they put their own like rated T for teen or teen plus for a little bit older of an audience or a mature audience or an all ages, and they put their own labels on it right now. So it's a little bit different than how it was traditionally.
But the degree of edginess is still common sense, and most consumers can understand what's going on, and parents are just as aware as most kids now, I'd imagine.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that you're going to see that, in all forms of entertainment growing up, whether it's the video games that you play, whether it's the movies that you watch, and definitely the comic books that you read. But I think that there's something for absolutely everybody, inside the medium.
And what makes your conventions really true to form is the fact that you really honor the artists that create the basic form. Is that it?
Yeah, we believe, and thank you for bringing that up, because we believe in showcasing the architects of pop culture. These men and women created the characters that you see in TV shows, blockbuster movies. They create these characters are on our video games, the toys that we collect, the graphic novels that we read. If you go into the mall or a Target department store, you're going to see tons of T-shirts and hats and gear. And these are all the people that are actually responsible for it.
Thank you so much.
What I like to make the analogy is that if you were able to go and hang out with Walt Disney and watch Walt Disney Disney movies with the creator of that franchise, you'd jump at the chance.
And now we can jump.
At Hawaii Comic Con, you have that opportunity.
I think we will get the opportunity. I wish we could talk more, but we have to keep moving on. Jimmy J., thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, and we love the show. And you have a great weekend.
Sure will. Jimmy J. is the amazing Comic-Con convention organizer. He brings amazing Comic-Con to the Hawaii Convention Center next weekend. See Hawaii Conversations page and Facebook.
Here to fight the force of evil, and your chance won't be denied. Woman of the hour, with your superpower, we're so proud.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
With the threat of Zika and what Hawaii has already experienced with dengue, a big question is how to safeguard Hawaii's blood supply. With no clinically approved tests for the viruses and Zika yet not in Hawaii, the blood bank is taking proactive measures. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Aloha Friday, Bethany.
And you too. Looking at how do we keep the blood supply clean is obviously what this is all about. And because you can't test for Zika and dengue in blood, at least have reliable tests, where does this leave us in trying to make sure that if we need blood later, we're going to have enough?
It leaves us vulnerable. We only have one blood bank, the Blood Bank of Hawaii. That's for the state, the entire state of Hawaii. And many people probably didn't know that during that recent dengue outbreak on the Big Island, the blood bank actually stopped taking donations from that area. It included Kona. It does have the bank enough to sustain blood supply for 3 days, but it's unclear how many people that would serve, right? Different people, different needs or transfusions. It's a case-by-case thing. But the scenario here is that if for some reason there were a serious Zika or dengue outbreak, and by the way, Hawaii is at risk in particular for Zika right now, would we have to import blood from the mainland? And if we did have to do that, it would be at a tremendously high cost.
3 day supply. I mean, most people think about a couple of days, and we talk about how much food you need to have, but We don't talk that much about how much blood we need to have if we seriously needed to have a lot of people transfused, and how we would move it island to island.
Exactly. In Puerto Rico, a comparable experience there, its blood bank shut down for 6 weeks when they had a Zika outbreak. They had to import blood. $4.2 million total is a charge for that. So what is the blood bank doing about it? Well, they're trying to work on prevention and awareness. They are looking at, you know, asking donors, what are your symptoms? If you do have symptoms of Zika or dengue, let's report those. Ask about travel activity, where you've been. As we know, by the way, there's a siren going down Wiley Avenue right now, so I apologize for that. If you could pick that up a little bit.
We got it, but that's okay. That's what real-life radio is all about.
It is, exactly. Underscoring the crisis. And just to finish up here, also looking for ways to test that blood. The FDA is looking at a recently approved clinical trial. They're looking at maybe sterilizing blood donations. But none of this is concrete right now. For now, we are still in this situation of only having 3 days' supply. Should an outbreak occur, mosquito-borne illness, we would be in serious trouble.
And are they also asking people to donate more blood now to be able to stockpile?
I don't know that that was in the report, but certainly I think it's fair to say the Blood Bank of Hawaii always welcomes donors, but there will be a screening process to make sure that you are not a potential, that your blood is clean, if you will.
All right. Well, thanks, Chad. Have a clean and fun weekend.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat. It's now 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. If you want to be in touch, you can call our talkback line at 792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or me at BKOZHPR. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, tax breaks for Hawaii organic farmers, and later, a fine cup from Kau. Here's the BBC. That's the news from the world, taking a look at our world right here in Hawaii. We've got Hawaii Public Radio's news director, Bill Dorman, joining us for a preview of what they're working on for next week. And first, let's talk about the fact that we're coming into summer, and we haven't had a whole lot of rain this last winter.
It's true.
That means wildfires in
dry, yeah, wildfires and drought. And we're heading for an above average wildfire season across the islands. The National Interagency Fire Center has already told us that. Also, some bad news about drought, saying the islands are entering a typically dry time of year, so drought will likely persist or get worse, even with normal precipitation. So you combine these two things, and for one bit, you have a need for public awareness, and this is where DLNR is stepping in and saying we need to get some word out about. So there's going to be an event, including firefighters from Nanakuli, fresh from fighting the brush fire there a couple months ago, to provide tips for homeowners of what to do. Also, folks from the National Weather Service, Honolulu Fire Department, Wildfire Management Organization, and that'll all kick off. Molly Solomon will wrap that up and sort of tell us what we need to know out of that.
Taking a look at arts and culture, we talk a lot about a great many things. Sometimes photography is in there. And it is, at least for next week.
Yeah, it's going to be a focus. A different kind of exhibit this month at Arts at Mark's Garage, downtown Honolulu. It's for Maui Arts Month, titled The Lab, Experiments in Photography. Three artists are featured, Kapilani Landgraf, Ualani Davis, and Drew Hara. Three different styles, but all carrying on that idea of experimentation in different ways, even through the process of developing the photos and how that comes out in terms of what people see. I'll leave more of the explanation to Noe Tanigawa, but she'll be along with that next week as well.
We've also been following the story with the Honolulu Zoo, and next week the city council is also going to take up an issue with them.
Yeah, exactly. So the city council budget committee takes up the concept of creating a Honolulu Zoo fund. And as you know, the zoo lost its accreditation in March because of money concerns, basically a lack of consistency in funding and the way that mechanism is set up. And before the zoo reapplies to the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, that funding piece needs to be addressed. So they're looking into doing this, providing the zoo with a dedicated and sustainable source of funding. And this is just a starting point, but it'll be interesting to see what comes out on that. Wayne Yoshioka will have that.
Oh, good. That'll be a good update. We talked a little bit about that when that idea was first floated, and we'll see what happens with it as we move into next week and hear from the city council and from Wayne Yoshioka. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. He joins us weekly with a preview of the coming week's attractions. Also on a Friday, we read your letters and emails, and following yesterday's conversation with Mom Dr. Rena Shaw about her family disagreement over vaccinating their 2-year-old, we got this note.
Hi, I am a practicing internist, and I was just listening to HPR this morning about vaccines and autism. There was a mom who said she vaccinated her 2-year-old child, although her husband and parents did not really agree. It was mentioned on the radio that her husband and his siblings were not vaccinated as a child, and they were healthy. I want to make sure that there should be another sentence that follows that remark. The reason he and his siblings are healthy without any of those illnesses is that the vaccines are protecting them because of the herd immunity. Therefore, everyone who says that they are healthy without vaccinations, we must educate them that they are benefiting from herd immunity. That's H-E-R-D. Without herd immunity, I am pretty sure those unvaccinated children would have those illnesses we have seen many years ago prior to vaccination. It's signed Emily Jip.
All right. Actually, I think she says deep.
Deep. Sorry.
Thanks very much for that letter. And if you'd like to send us one, you can at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or you can call our talkback line anytime you like at 808-792-8217. Getting the USDA certified organic designation can be a costly process, and it's why some farmers who ostensibly farm organically say they just can't afford to pursue the paperwork. But after this legislative session, they are getting some help, potentially. Hawaii is poised to become the first state to offer would-be organic farmers a big break, up to $50,000 in tax credits. Sean Anderson is just the kind of farmer who would take up that deal should Governor Ige approve it or allow it to become law, and that could mean a whole lot more green to grow the organic produce consumers want. Sean Anderson joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about your operation, Green Rose Farm. You ostensibly do farm organically, but what has been the barrier between you and the certification?
So I've been going organically for the last 4 years. Really, I started my farm with the intention to sort of an experiment, like how far can we push this beyond organic, growing without chemical inputs, with limited fossil fuel inputs and things like that. The biggest barrier to getting organic certified is really the cost and the amount of paperwork. And because I'm a small-scale farm, I do most of my sales direct to consumers at the farmer's market or off my farm or through CSA programs, things like that. So I have the opportunity to educate my consumer, and they can see exactly what my practices are. So it hasn't been hugely important for me to have that label on my products.
But if you wanted to, say, go into a major grocery store or a major, you know, wholesale chain,
exactly,
you'd have to be able to have that designation and to be able to prove all the way through,
exactly,
to be able to get it. So what kind of money are you talking about?
The cost primarily of the certification itself, but also the cost associated with the time that it would take to maintain all the paperwork. Everything that they require for organic certification is just a lot of more work. It's really an additional job. I mean, I'm out there farming, maintaining all these practices. To then keep all these records that they require is really an additional job.
So you're going to have to hire somebody else?
Potentially, or I can put that time myself and then, you know, write it off, or potentially hire someone else to do that for me.
So most people are asking, so how much does it really cost for somebody to be able to get certification?
It depends on the size of your farm and how many products you're doing and how many products you want to get organic certified. But the truth is that any additional cost really to farming is huge. You know, there's already such a slim margin on farming that any additional cost can really make or break what, you know, the success of your farm. So it's strange that organic farmers are being required to, you know, keep records of all their whatever they use, while the large scale farms that are using toxic chemicals and things like that are able to just do that without having to get certified. You know, I really think it should be, you should have to get certified unorganic, you know, to prove what chemicals you're using. And the organic guys, you know, that shouldn't require any extra paperwork.
But as we're talking about, you know, giving would-be organic farmers a serious tax break here,
yeah.
which would certainly help you a whole lot. Still, a lot of people are wondering, well, you know, how much are we talking in dollars and cents? Other states have talked about $750, $1,000, slightly over $1,000 to do that.
Right.
Is that in the neighborhood of what it would be for you?
Absolutely. I think I was quoted, my farm is about 3 acres, would be somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500 just for the certification. And that's an annual fee for that certification. But that doesn't take into consideration all of the additional time.
Right. And for a small farmer who is trying to do a lot on his own with maybe you and a couple of people.
Exactly.
$1,500 looks like a whole lot.
Sure.
So if you get certified, what does that mean for how you change your practices from what you're doing now? Really any change at all, or just that somebody has said that what you're doing is okay?
Exactly. There's really no change. What we do on our farm is really beyond organic. We are growing food in a way that is more than just replacing conventional inputs for organically certified inputs, organic pesticides and organic fertilizers. We are growing using regenerative soil building practices, natural farming practices, a blend of permaculture, natural farming, biodynamics, Korean natural farming, grading all of our inputs on our farm, doing a lot of composting, cycling waste from our system, generating soil health using microorganisms and things like that. So our type of agriculture is really different from conventional agriculture, quote-unquote conventional agriculture, which isn't very conventional.
Do you have a sense of how many farmers would be in your position and would be able to avail themselves of tax credits that are being proposed?
Yes, there's a huge growing number of farmers that are growing organically already and getting into farming, small-scale farmers. And I hope that this bill encourages them to go down the route of getting certified organic. I hope that this bill encourages a lot of farmers to switch over to organic so that we can bring organic certification and organic certified produce as the standard baseline of food production. And then we can move beyond organic certification and start to look at some of the other really important issues like soil health and nutrition and access to food, which are all huge issues of the food movement.
So how do you talk to other farmers that might be in the same position as yours? How many of you are there?
There is a huge growing number of farmers within my group in Waimanalo. We recently started a farmer co-op, a cooperative called the Friends with Farms Co-op, and there's about 12 of us in our co-op. But every year, people are going through programs at UH, like the Go Farm program, getting into farming. You have hundreds of thousands of people across the country, young people that are wanting to take up farming and wanting to do it a different way, and they're doing it organically.
But getting the land can be an issue.
Exactly. There's a lot of barriers besides just the cost of getting organically certified to starting a farm and becoming a successful farmer.
Even on 3 acres or 5 acres?
Especially on 3 acres and 5 acres, which are the ideal size farms that we want to start to see more of, rather than these huge 25 or 1,000 acre farms. We need many, many, many more farmers on smaller pieces of land, managing this land responsibly, ethically, without chemical inputs, without a reliance on fossil fuels and heavy machinery and the industrialized system of producing food.
And a lot of people might add growing stuff that we can actually eat.
Growing stuff we can actually eat that's healthy.
As opposed to importing it.
Exactly, exactly.
Sean, thank you so much for coming in. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Sean Anderson is the founder and farm manager of Green Rose Farm in Waimanalo. He's also vice president of the Hawaii Farmers Union United, Oahu chapter, and sits on the board of the Friends with Farms Cooperative. And we'll find out more once we know whether Governor Ige actually will sign this bill.
From Hilo's performance poetry group Spirit and Flesh here on the Big Island. You're tuned in to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we ask you about a type of honey that is only produced here in Hawaii. The reason that this honey can only be made here is that it's derived from a flower unique to Hawaii, Hawaii Island, to be more specific. The honey, which shares its name with its parent flower, is known for having a very light color, slightly crystallized texture, and a profound floral taste. Due to the blooming cycle of the flower, this honey can only be harvested 3 months out of the year, making it even more of a delicacy. Legend has it that the flower in question was originally a human whom the gods turned into a flower after the volcano goddess Pele turned the woman's lover into a tree. Of course, we're talking about the lehua flower, which only grows on the ohia tree. And ohia lehua honey is today's answer.
Dylan Shackman called us from Kapahulu, knew the answer, and will be receiving the HPR T-shirt. Now at 8:46, that's your answer to today's quiz. If you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Honey, come back. Sometime I'm on a red back jack. Sometime I get a hump in my back. Sometime I'm going over here. Sometime, can my honey come back? Sometime I'm on a red back jack. Sometime I get a hump in my back. Sometime I'm going over here.
On June 8th in HPR's Atherton Studio, get up close and personal with John Hammond, one of the world's top acoustic blues players. For station members only, it'll be just you, John, his guitar, harmonica, and stories of sharing the stage with people like John Lee Hooker, Tom Waits, and lots of others. Reserve your premium tickets by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Not so very long ago, when you mentioned coffee from the 50th state, folks from the mainland and the rest of the world immediately thought of Kona coffee. But now, coffee grows in Kauai, Oahu, Maui, and Molokai, as well as Hawaii's Kona district. But there's another Hawaii Island coffee-growing district besides Kona, and it's winning world-class awards. Hawaii Coffee Association Director Chris Manfredi joins us with a look at the brew from Kau. Aloha, Chris. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Hi, Bill. Good morning to you.
Now, a little bit of background. Kau originally was known as a sugar district.
Yeah. For many years, Kau sugar was very prevalent in the district, and whatever wasn't planted in sugar was used for cattle ranching.
And were there a couple of coffee growers there from the get-go?
There were some early efforts to raise coffee in Kau, but the competition for land and labor just couldn't get a foothold on the sugar industry.
So it was always sort of a very, very distant little secondary interest for the region.
Yeah, just out of necessity, I think, from a workforce perspective, just couldn't compete for land and labor.
And then times began to change around the turn of the century when sugar phased out in Hawaii and all this land became available?
Yeah, what happened in the mid to late 90s was the sugar companies began to close and begin to lay off workers. And thankfully, a lot of the former sugar plantation workers were given affordable leases to start smallholder coffee farms.
So how many coffee farms are there out there now?
There's about 50 and growing.
And it really started taking off in terms of quality when?
Well, I think the quality was always there.
Mm-hmm.
It was more of a awareness factor that Kau was able to begin to develop its own origin and its own identity.
Everybody's heard of Kona. That was the primary coffee district. And, of course, Kauai had some, and then Molokai got some, and then you have some growing in Oahu now. So each area seems to be getting its own cachet, its own identification. When did the identification for Kau really begin to take off?
Well, in 2007, working together with the growers there, we were able to enter a number of coffees into SCAA competitions. SCAA is the Specialty Coffee Association of America, and it's the largest organization of its kind in the world. And Kau Coffee scored very well in that competition. We were entering that competition every year since, culminating in 2013, where we earned 3 of the top 10 coffees in the world. And over time, we were named International Coffee of the Year 5 times.
When you reach a point where you really get the high accolades, do you find it a difference between gourmet pricing and quote, run-of-the-mill coffee, does it begin to, is there a trade-off point where you charge too much, or how does that balance out?
Well, it's an interesting question, and thanks for asking it. In order to be a successful coffee farmer in Hawaii, it's a necessity that you're able to command a higher price.
Mm-hmm.
There's a commodity coffee market, and then there's a specialty coffee market. And Hawaiian coffees don't typically fit into the commodity market.
Just because there's not enough of it?
Well, because the cost of farming is so high, you couldn't compete in a commodity market for coffee.
Land in Colombia is versus land in Hawaii, for example.
And labor.
Mm-hmm.
Labor's a big one.
So here we are with the specialty market, and you've got the higher costs. On average, though, it seems that the demand never diminishes just because of the quality. Is that right?
That's a big part of it, and, you know, it's a function of awareness. I mean, we have to continually work to reach new markets, not just Ka'u as an origin, but Hawaiian coffee industry as an industry unto itself.
So you've got the price-quality change-off. Now, you talked about affordable leases for the people that want to grow coffee. That's a big part of it, isn't it?
Well, that was, as I said, back in the mid to late 90s. So that was able to give the laid-off plantation workers an ability to get those farms started. Land leases are not cheap in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much that is cheap in Hawaii. And you know, the pricing and the business model that surrounds Hawaiian coffee is a function of that. And in order to be sustainable, we have to command high prices. And in order to command the high prices, we have to have exceptional quality.
Exactly. So what is sort of the difference in the price differential between the commodity and the specialty coffee? What sort of range are you talking?
Well, for example, on a wholesale green bean level, which is before it gets roasted, commodity coffees trade from 50 cents to maybe the better ones, $1, $1.50.
This is per pound?
This is per pound. And Hawaiian coffees will typically trade from $15 to $22.
So when you're processing the coffee, you start with the green bean and then you got to pulp them and roast. Is all that now done on site in Ka'u District?
Well, yeah, just an overview of the process. It's hand picked.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's picked off the trees, that's called a coffee cherry or coffee
cherry,
berry.
That's right.
And then that gets wet processed where it gets pulped. Then that gets dried, and that's all done by the sun. This is all hand process. After it dries by the sun, then it's dry milled where the parchment skin is taken off, and that leaves you with a product that's known as green bean. That green bean is then roasted, and that gives you the coffee beans that you'll buy in the store before it's ground that most people are familiar with.
And so getting through all that, it used to be when they were starting most that they had to go up to Kona for the closest milling?
Well, most of the small farmers have their own wet mill operations.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some centralized dry mill operations and roasting operations that are not only in Kona. There's some in Mountain View. There's some in Hilo and also now in Ka'u.
So with the success of it so far, it's truly self-sustaining and growing?
Yes, that is accurate.
What about the actual acreage? Is there more acreage to be planted in the Ka'u District, or is it pretty much reaching capacity?
No, we have a lot of room for expansion. We started out with about 280 acres. That quickly grew to about 500, and there's plans for considerably more in the near and distant future.
And those sort of processes and expansion and everything else, there's a Ka'u Coffee Festival coming up, which will explain to a lot of Ka'u coffee fans exactly how good it is. And we'd really like to thank you for being with us today, Chris, and we hope that the coffee drinkers appreciate what's coming in Ka'u, and for that I will have my morning sip and say this is wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Chris Manfredi is a coffee industry leader and organizer of the 8th Ka'u Coffee Festival, which kicks off today and runs through the 22nd. He's the vice president of the statewide Hawaii Farm Bureau and director of Hawaii Coffee Association. Ka'u is the state's largest agricultural district and encompasses the entire south end, windward to leeward of the Big Island. To find out more, visit our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
There will always be a rainbow and another lovely day at my
my coffee shack by Kalapana Bay. At my coffee shack by Kalapana Bay.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
And I'm watching you sip. That was a very, very noisy sip. But, yeah, you've been drinking that ka'u coffee this morning.
I got to say, every once in a while, I'm not going to gush, but I'm just going to say, if you haven't tried it, do it.
All right, so you've given it your endorsement, and we'll let you do that since you don't sit in with us all the time. And many, many thanks for joining us over the last couple of weeks while Chris has been away. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a delight to be here. Triskaidekaphobia aside, we survived a Friday of that particular date incident, and somehow we survived.
Oh, well, Friday the 13th. It's not a bad
thing.
Don't
say it. Don't even say it.
Well, it hasn't been a bad one, at least on this side. But, yeah, it's been really a pleasure to hear your take on certain things that we've been talking about this week. But as for what's going to happen next week, well, we're going to follow up and get Avalon's side of the Local 5 Halinane strike story. Steve Gold, the vice president for the Hawaii region for Avalon Healthcare, will be here.
Plus two conversations with two musicians who have new releases this year, Ian O'Sullivan and Nancy Shoup Wu.
We like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like. It's available 24/7. Leave us your comments at this number, and we'll play them once a week, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like social, you can post your comments on Facebook. Our page is Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or if you want to tweet me, and I'll tweet back, at BKOZHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information on the Conversation page or the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants. And today we say goodbye to Alex Abe, who's been our spring intern.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Chris Vandercook and I will be back on Monday, and we'll pick up the conversation. Meanwhile, have a great weekend.